Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition podcast, sponsored by the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. I'm Brian O'Connor, adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at Chicago Booth. And joining me today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Trevor Lewin, former CEO and current board member and investor of T-Base Communications and Booth alumni. Trevor, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks, Brian. Nice to be here. How are you doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Well, let's jump in, Trevor. One, maybe we'll take a couple minutes and just explore why and how you came to find your way into this search fund or ETA path after graduating from Booth. We'll spend just a little bit of time on that because I really want to dig into some of the details and the situation around T-Base Communications and your recent exit. So Give us a little insight into how you came into this world of ETA.
Yeah, it was actually kind of by accident in some ways. As you know, Brian, in 2012, which is the year I graduated from the executive MBA program at Booth, there really wasn't a lot of search fund community yet built up at Booth. And so the way I first found out about search funds is my former life, I worked in mergers and acquisitions in the mid-market, dealing with transactions values typically between 10 million enterprise value to like 150 million in enterprise value. And we happened to have a couple of young guys come into our office looking for deal flow. And they actually had capital. And so I was wondering, how did these two young guys end up with some capital and are looking for deals? And when we discussed it, they said they were a search fund. They were the second search fund in Canada, actually. And so when I heard about it, it really resonated with me. And I was pretty much, I think it was around the time when I was doing my studies at Booth. And so you might not know this, but probably one of the first informal conferences for Booth ETA was done in a little classroom in 2012, where we flew up one of the guys from that search fund, and he put on a little seminar with about 10 of my colleagues from EXP 81 class. And so we were all curious to hear about it. And so that's how it kind of started. That's how I found out about it, just through some other guys doing it. And then we got into it.
And Trevor, I understand you operated your search in partnership with another individual named Bruce.
Yeah.
You were based in Canada for your search. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the decision to partner. And also, were you looking at exclusively Canadian companies, or were you also looking in the United States?
Sure. Yeah. So Bruce is someone who I'd worked with professionally for 15 years. So I knew him really well. I mean, we literally sat on opposite sides of a cubicle wall for a long time. And we worked on deals together in M&A. We both had this sort of entrepreneurial spirit. And we wanted to have a chance to try our hand at operations and not just be pigeonholed as financial guys for the rest of our lives. And so the timing was right. We knew each other well. You know, we started investing in some search funds. And a lot of times people ask us, like, why did you do it as a partnership? You know, and should I get a partner? I think you have to take that decision really carefully. I happened to know Bruce for 15 years. I knew his wife. I knew his kids. You know, he knew my wife, knew my kids. I knew what drove him. He knew what drove me. And so we had this really good understanding of each other's skill sets, how we think. And there was an extremely deep trust between us. And I think almost more importantly than anything for me, when I'm thinking about whether or not you should go into a partnership, is you have to be able to let go of ego because you got to just focus on how do I increase value, not focus on who's getting the credit. If you have to do some work in the shadows and you don't really get the credit for it, but it's adding value and you can live with that, and both of you can live with that, that tends to be a really good partnership. So if you have really strong trust and you can park the egos, I think it works out really well. And so the second part of your question, I think, was about Canada?
Yeah, just geographic. And we can get through that quickly because I really do want to talk about, you know, T-Base and how you found it. But yeah, any parameters around your search? Was it Canadian exclusively, or were you focused on other geographies as well?
It was Canadian exclusively, and even more, I guess, precise, it was really GTA, Greater Toronto Area specific. Like we kind of said, within an hour drive of Toronto. And again, I think we were maybe the fourth search fund ever in Canada. And so we got away with it at the time. I don't think you'd get away with it anymore. And so,
in the sense that that might be too tight a geographic parameter.
Exactly. So we were industry agnostic. Obviously, the industry had to fit the profile that you look for a search fund, but we were industry agnostic. But our goal geographically was kind of within a 1 hour drive of Toronto. What ended up happening is we found T-based communications when we really loved it, which is a 4 hour drive away from Toronto. And we decided to go ahead with it because it was just a really interesting company. But again, I don't think it would be easy to do such a tight geography anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense, Trevor. Great segue. Let's talk about T-Base, how you found it. And then I'd love to dig in and understand for our listeners a little bit better about the business model and what T-Base Communications is all about.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we didn't really do anything, I would say, extremely different from what a lot of search funds do today. You know, we did a balance of proprietary search. We used interns. I think the people who are doing it today do it much better than we do right now. They have like well-oiled machines with, 10 plus interns. And we did a good job. But what I hear about what search funders are doing or search fund people are doing now, and it blows my mind. But we were doing the proprietary and we were using intermediaries. We probably put a little bit more weight on intermediaries than some other searchers do. And that's because my background, I was an intermediary and I really knew that network really well, especially given we were looking geographically in a tight spot. I knew that community and so did Bruce. And so this actually came in through an intermediary and it came through actually CIBC has a mid-market investment banking shop. And one of the individuals who worked there, a great guy, he actually worked at CIBC when I worked at CIBC. And we actually helped interview him like 15 years prior when he was just coming into industry as an analyst. Fast forward 15, 17 years, and now he's running deals. And so he had this deal. He knew what I was doing. He called me up and he said, I got this company. It's a little small, but I think you'd be interested in it. Do you want to take a look? And that's how we got to know about T-Base. We were put into a process and we had to compete.
Trevor, I think there's some good learning in that for our listeners. I mean, I think that whether you go the proprietary route or through intermediaries, and I would argue that there's probably room for a healthy combination and mix of both in a good search. You know, I often hear searchers talk about trying to boil the ocean and be everything to everyone. And what I heard you say in this intermediated process is that you had an angle. It was a relationship that you had developed for years and years, had a unique angle on that process and thought about it thought small about it, thought about that one relationship and how do I maybe get a unique angle on this opportunity. I love that. There's some learning in that.
Yeah, I would say there's sort of two things on the angle. You're absolutely right on relationship. You know, there's so many intermediaries out there and we made a whole list, but we kind of labeled them gold, bronze, silver. And our touch points were different for the golds versus, you know, the bronzes. And so we covered them like crazy, the golds. And so they always knew what we're looking for. And the other thing, and this maybe goes contrary to what most people think, but being a former intermediary, and this is my advice to searchers that are speaking with intermediaries, is the last thing an intermediary wants to hear when they ask the question, what industries do you want to focus on, is anything. Because as soon as you say that as a searcher, they'll never remember you. And so I know that you want to be tempted to say anything because you don't want to miss any deal flow from an intermediary. But if you say these three or four industries are really what I'm looking at hard, when they see that industry, they'll remember you and they'll call you. And then you can continue that conversation at that point and say, what else do you have in your pipeline? But it's so easy to get sort of lost in an intermediary's mind if they don't have specific things they can hang on to what your brand is.
I think that's great advice, Trevor. All right, let's talk about T-Base. So tell us a little bit about the business and what you and Bruce were attracted to.
And, you know, this story is going to be very similar to a lot of stories you've probably heard searchers get into, Brian, whereby you end up in an industry you didn't even know existed before. So we weren't targeting this industry. So what T-Base does is they use proprietary software to convert traditional documents into documents that low vision and blind people can understand. That means taking a traditional document, putting it into Braille or reflow large print or accessible PDF or other forms of audio. And this is something which is highly needed by large corporations because the Americans with Disabilities Act requires them to provide alternate forms of communications to low vision and blind people if requested. And so I had no idea this world existed, but it's a really interesting dynamic for a search fund because one, it has a regulatory compliance angle to it. Secondly, it has a demographic tailwind to it. As you get older, people's vision deteriorates. It doesn't mean to be blind, but if you're low vision, you need these tools as well. And so that's always expanding every year. What we did a lot was statements. So think of bank statements, cell phone bills, health bills, all those sort of things. And so it's actually not tied to cycles of the economy. In a recession or even a depression, people might have less in their bank account, but they still have a bank account. And if they have a bank account, they get a statement. And so we were getting paid every time we did a statement conversion. And the other part about this is it's recurring. So you get these statements every month, right? And so you've got recurring, anti-cyclical, compliance angle, demographic driven, you know, a very large audience that you're dealing with, and incredible stickiness to the client. So this is why we decided to drive 4 hours, because it made sense for this.
And I just have a pedestrian understanding of your business, yeah. Trevor, but I would also argue there's probably some attractiveness to the combination of low share of wallet for that client and the critical nature of what you're providing, right? Those two coupled probably added a lot to the stickiness that you just talked about there.
Absolutely. That's a double-edged sword for sure. Because on one hand, you're absolutely right, creates a stickiness. The other part, because it's a small piece of a larger size of our client's P&L, it's hard to get their attention sometimes.
Yeah.
Until their existing vendor does something wrong. Or you're getting sued by the ADA. It's hard to get their attention. So the sales cycles were long.
Yeah. Okay, great. Trevor, let's shift gears. I want to go back. I want to bring your partner, Bruce, back into this conversation that we're having and talk about how you both thought about your roles in this business post-investment. And you talked about how the partnership was formed and built in trust and a long-term relationship. So you're making the acquisition. You're both obviously very talented people. How do you sort of decide who does what and when do we both get involved and when do we let each other stay in our lanes?
That's a really good question. And our solution was met with not always agreement by our investors on this point. And so what we did is we both took on co-CEO titles, which not only didn't some of our investors not love that idea, because they always said someone's got to be the boss, even the selling owners, which were rolling some equities, didn't necessarily love the idea. And so we had to sell it, but we were pretty firm on it. Bruce and I said, we're going to this as a partnership. We're going to leave this as a partnership. We're putting the same amount of equity capital in, and we're putting the same risk. And so we did. But what we did to make it a little bit more easy for our investors and the employees and the selling shareholders, we put ourselves on the org chart, whereby I tended to do a little bit more work on the finance side and he tended to do a little bit more on the sales side. But the reality was, outside of those formalized sort of structured trees on a PowerPoint slide, it was kind of, hey, do you have bandwidth to take this on? Yeah, I do. I'll take that one on. Or, you know, we shared the same office. And so we talked all the time. It was like if I was working on something on the finances, he knew what I was working on and helped me out with it. And if he was trying to figure out how to, you know, penetrate a potential prospect, I was listening to it and helping him think through it. And so in the end, it was very, you could say it was inefficient in the sense that we were both kind of doing the same things, but it was very efficient when it came to decision making, because we didn't explain the context of anything. We totally knew the context of everything because we were just working always at the same time.
So Trevor, that's an interesting approach. And I mean, you often hear in partnered searches that people really understand their swim lanes, stay in them, and really only tend to overlap where there's a need for a big decision, right? Mm-hmm. Would you do anything differently, you know, in the way that you and Bruce approached it? Or did you feel like ultimately the best outcomes for the business were derived from the way that you handled this overlapping on occasion of roles and responsibilities?
I wouldn't change anything about the overlapping. It worked out really well for Bruce and I. I can't say it worked well for everybody else, but it worked really well for us. And again, I think that's partly because we always parked our egos. So, but the one thing I think that tends to do, and I think I wrote this in a blog for Booth, is you tend to rely on each other almost exclusively, and maybe you lack engaging your executive management team, you know, a little bit because of that. Yeah. And I think if I was to do it over again, I'd try to make sure that the EMT, the executive management team, was a little bit more engaged in our day-to-day conversations that Bruce and I were having. And we asked them questions about the way we were thinking a little bit more, just to keep them a little bit more engaged. They're smart people. They probably could have added some really good creative thoughts to things. So that's my only thing, which maybe I'd try to be more conscious about if I was to do it again.
So that's an interesting learning in that around engagement of your leadership team. Can you sort of share some insights into how that might apply to your board? How did you and Bruce engage with your board? And would you have maybe done anything differently or less or more, sort of in the same context that you just shared about your EMT?
Yeah. Our board was myself, Bruce, one of the selling shareholders, Kent Weaver, and Bill Egan. And I would, if you ever ask Bill Egan about Bruce and Trevor, he'd probably say, you know, he kind of feels guilty because we hardly ever call him. And he said we were always low maintenance. I don't know if that was a compliment or a complaint, because maybe on one hand, he was thinking, you know, you guys should be engaging us more. On the other hand, he probably was happy that we weren't taking up a ton of his time. But I've heard other people really engage their boards much more so than Bruce and I did. I'm a mixed thoughts about that one, Brian, because I find like boards, and I might be wrong in this for saying this for most boards, but the people that are board directors that have never been in the business, they can never really understand the context of everything like the people that are in it day to day. And so when you're making a decision, sometimes it's hard to communicate the nuances of things. And so I think Bruce and I often did a lot of on our own. And in some cases, it was more reporting to our board on what's happening. On the very big picture stuff, no question, you know, Kent and Bill, extremely skilled and experienced. They let us understand the bigger picture and guidance, no question about it. But on the more sort of tactical type things, it was mostly Bruce and I talking about that sort of stuff.
Yeah, great. Trevor, let's talk a little bit about, and we'll get to one of the big strategic decisions that you all made in your somewhat recent exit, which was approximately a year and a half ago. But let's first, before we go there, talk about, you know, sort of the partnership between you and Bruce. We've talked about how roles were established within that. What went well over the, how long did you own the business? You know, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced along the way? You know, what were some of the biggest sort of exciting and growth oriented areas? Tell us a little bit about the holding period before we get to the ultimate kind of strategic decision that was made in exiting the business.
Sure. Well, on one part, it was just putting a little bit more time and effort into the sales and marketing side. If your sales are growing, it covers up a lot of mistakes. And so we put in a lot of time on that. And our nature of our product was a long, complex sales cycle, very akin in relationship building, actually, to our old pitching work when we were investment bankers. You got to spend a lot of time developing relationships with private equity firms or owners of businesses before you get the mandate. And then you have to put this big pitch book together to try to win it. So we brought that mentality to the sales and marketing. We really enhanced our decks. When we went into, you know, a Fortune 500 company to pitch our services, it was very professionalized, the book. It looked like an investment banking deck, which our competitors, because they were mid-market companies, I don't think we're doing the same sort of thing. So we gave him a lot of comfort from that perspective. So the sales and marketing, Bruce and I got quite engaged in, along with our account managers during that time frame. The other part that we did was we looked for bottlenecks in the business. What were the inefficiencies? What were the things that weren't automated from a software perspective? And so one of our COO, a guy named Mike Hatfield, had a great idea about taking some of the automation in the software that we were doing for statement work that I talked about and bringing it to much more complex documents. Like think of like a calculus textbook, which is not a standardized type of document. But how do you do that? Well, you have to create really good graphic user interfaces for your operators, and you have to start bringing in some machine learning to look for pattern recognition within these textbooks. And so we started doing that. And so we took that process from being a fully manual, you have to use a subject matter expert that's in Braille and doing everything sort of word by word and line by line, to helping bring in a lot of technology and streamlining that and making it more scalable. And that actually is still evolving today. And we have some really exciting things which we're pushing forward, which we think ultimately will change the industry on how these complex documents are converted. So it was those two things. It was focusing on the sales and marketing for us, and then also looking for the bottlenecks, things that weren't automated that we could automate with technology. I would say those are the two biggest things that we focused on.
That's great, Trevor. Any unforeseen or, we put together these long investment memos that identify all the risks and mitigants, but what came up that was maybe unforeseen or different than you had anticipated getting into this business?
Yeah. I get that question asked sometime, and I wish I had a better anecdotal story that we could play with, Brian, but when we put our book out on to our investors, but looking at T-Base, and we said, here's what the 5-year plan is. You look back at the 5-year, it was pretty close. It was actually pretty close. And yeah. But I would say the biggest surprises.
Well, no need to apologize about that, Trevor. That's a pretty good thing when it works out that way.
Well, I think it was a little bit lucky, but I would say the things that are the most unpredictable is the human element factor in your staff. We had people that lost very close family members, people that got sick, people that just had personal issues, people that had aspirations, people that obviously weren't performing well, people that didn't get along with each other, people that you trained and put a lot of time into, and then maybe they left. It was always the HR element, which was for us the most unpredictable thing on our side. We had very little in the way of vendors, so that was never a problem. And our customer lists, long sales cycles, but predictable who you're prospecting and stuff like that. So a lot of our variables we had some control over or be able to see. And the industry is so regulated that you didn't see a lot of swings from that perspective. So I would say it was the HR element for us, just managing that day to day.
Yeah. And Trevor, you won't be surprised when I tell you that many of the operators and CEOs that come on this show, that's the first thing that they cite, right? Especially perhaps folks that come from a background like yours. I mean, before pursuing this, you were an investment banker and maybe didn't manage as large a team or as diverse a team as it relates to career experiences, et cetera. And so I'm not at all surprised to hear maybe that was the biggest, unforeseen or curveballs that were thrown your way over the operating period. Yeah. Well, good. Let's spend a few minutes here exploring the ultimate sale that was effectuated in late 2019. So what led to the decision? How did you and your board and the key stakeholders know that it was the right time to pursue an exit?
Yeah. I think you and I had chatted a little bit about this in the past, but it was, we were coming close to the time when you need to think about this first off. So we started thinking a little bit harder after 4 years owning the business. But when we send out our regular document after our board minutes, we always marked our mark to market, the value of our equity based on the entry multiple. And one of our investors just said, I just think this is really way too conservative given what's happening in the markets right now. Multiples have expanded incredibly across all industries. You should really talk to some investment bankers to see where you guys really are at, given the growth and everything. And so we did. And we called up about three or four, maybe actually more than that, maybe five or six investment bankers. And you know, they're always trying to sell you. So you always try to discount the multiples they tell you in their pitch books. But across the board, they were very excited about the business. They thought it would do really well. It surpassed that rule of 40 metric that everybody talks about by a lot. I think our rule of 40 by time of sale was something like 63% or something like that. So they felt it was a really good story. And they gave us a multiple, which was much higher than what we had thought. And we thought, hey, who knows how long multiples would be at this level? We're going to be approaching 5 years by the time this thing gets done. So we should probably take this to market. Not our board wasn't pushing us to do it. Our board was very happy with the path of business and what it could do going forward. But they knew that it could be a good deal for everyone. And so we decided to go ahead with the process. And so it was a pretty traditional approach. We hired an investment bank. We went pretty wide. It was really for sale to a private equity sponsor. It wasn't really a good play for strategics. And so, you know, you do the whole process, you go a lot and you narrow it down. But it wasn't a straight line. We had some hiccups along the way for sure.
Hey, Trevor, let's spend just a minute on this, right? It made sense at the board level. The economics, as you were going through the decision and talking to bankers, seemed to pencil. You know, that all made sense. And the board came to the conclusion that this would potentially, if you found the right buyer, you know, be the best thing for shareholders. How did you and Bruce think about it personally? You know, there's this sometimes tension or at least a balance that needs to be struck between what's right for the business, for the shareholders, and for the entrepreneurs that went down this path and their own sort of destiny, liquidity, et cetera.
Yeah. You know, I think when you're asking about that balance, probably the issue which rears its head a bit is if you're going to sell a company and you want to extract the highest multiple and it's done well, the business, you're probably going to be asked by the private equity firm to stay on for a transition period. You're probably going to be asked to roll some equity going forward. And the more equity you roll and the longer you stay, maybe your multiple will be better. But that might not be in line with the interest of the searchers. It's more interest in line with the interest of the investors because they want the highest multiple possible and they don't have to roll their equity and they don't have to stick around afterwards. And so that's where I think it becomes this bit of a balance. And I think you have to look at yourself as a searcher and just maybe get a little selfish at times and say, look, my valuation is going to be affected by this too, but is some of these other intangibles as important or more important? And I think everybody lands in a different spot on that question. For us, Bruce and I knew that we wanted to transition out at some point, and we didn't want to roll a ton. We had all our eggs in one basket with this thing, and we wanted a liquidity event so that going forward, we'd have more irons in the fire with different investments and stuff like that, where you can now have more patience and stuff. But this is one of those things where it's liquidity events right in front of you. Let's not mess this up. Let's just do what you need to do, but also for us, be able to see the exit, the transition out. And so,
Trevor, did you find that you had a healthy and open dialogue going with your board on some of these matters and considerations for you and Bruce individually vis-a-vis shareholders?
I would say very, very, very healthy. And so the beautiful thing about the search fund metric is that everybody is pretty aligned. I mean, if the searcher does well, the investors would do well. And so I think that our board always had that in mind. And so we rarely had conflicts on these sort of matters, and they were very supportive of us. And plus, I think I mentioned who our board members were. They understood how these things just played out, and we were very fair to them. They saw their returns are going to be good. So they were very supportive of what we wanted to do at the end.
That's great. Trevor, let's talk in the final minutes that we have here. Let's talk a little bit about the buyer and your new partner and sort of how that all came together, what it meant for you and Bruce going forward. Let's explore that.
Yeah. So we were really lucky to partner with Thompson Street Capital Partners out of St. Louis. Their team, incredibly professional, you know, have been in a lot of businesses. And so they have a pretty steady hand at the wheel. But I will say that there is a big difference, at least for us, between being managed by a more traditional search fund board and a more traditional private equity fund. And so the private equity fund has a lot of LPs, which have a lot of institutional investors, and there is a certain process, what they need as far as reports, metrics, conversations, cadence of conversations, professionalizing systems. And so we saw a lot more emphasis placed on the finance team. I mean, a lot. We weren't ready for it. And so there was a lot of pains in getting our finance team up to speed on that. And I would say there were just a lot of growing pains from the administrative perspective for us to catch up to what somebody like a Thompson would need. And so I think that was very different for us. You know, the search fund board for us was almost like, guys, go do your thing. If you need us, we're there to help you out, like for sure. But if you don't need us, just keep doing your thing. And I think that the private equity world, from our experience, is just much more engaged day to day.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
If you're going to go that way, make sure you pick a good partner and you get along with them. Because if you have someone who's very engaged and you don't get along with them, that could be a miserable existence. So we lucked out there with that. Well, I wouldn't say we lucked out. We factored that into our decision when we were picking our buyer.
Great. And then, you know, specifically, what did you and Bruce agree to at that point? How did what did the go forward commitments and relationship look like? And maybe then bring us to today. What is Trevor specifically and Bruce's involvement in the business? And then we'll wrap up with, I'd love to just get a little sense for maybe how you're spending, you know, your time and what you're looking to do next.
Sure. So, you know, in our sale process, Bruce and I, we always feel uncomfortable in not providing some transparencies to buyers. And so we always told, you know, the buyers and specifically Thompson Street, we're willing to transition as CEOs. We are. And we are going to be fully committed during the transition period. But we don't want to give more than 2 years. That is it. And, you know, you never know where you're going to be at 2 years. So we'll keep an open mind. But you should go into this thinking that you're only going to have us for 2 years. We didn't know how that would affect the multiple or anything like that. But we were going to a partnership. We wanted to make sure we had a level of trust. And I think that was appreciated by Thompson. But, you know, we went into this thing. We sold it 2019. Near the end of 2020, so a little over a year after close, they asked us, and we had this board meeting, how do you guys feel? Do you still feel like it's a two-year? And we said, yes, it's still going to be a two-year. And then we said, well, we better start looking at your successor then, because this could take longer than you think. And so we did. And it took way shorter than we thought. So they happened to have another CEO that had been one of their other portfolio companies that freed up. And so we made that transition like within weeks after thinking about doing this. So Bruce and I were highly replaceable. And so we did that.
I don't know if I believe that, Trevor, but yeah.
Yeah, we did. So it was. So we did that in January, and then we helped the new CEO transition, I think, for about 2 or 3 months. And so we left at the end of February as CEOs. So today, we're board members. We rolled some equity, so we still have some equity in the business. And we have some special projects that we still help out with T-Base, but the amount of hours have dialed back huge in what we do there. So right now, Bruce and I are trying to take a little time off, enjoy a little bit of peace, because you know, you're on this hamster wheel for a long time and you don't have a chance to take a breath. And I think it's important to take a breath once in a while. So we were doing that. But ever since we sold, we've always been engaged in the search fund community, and we've been talking with Bruce graduates that have been doing in other schools. And Bruce and I think, have put money to 10 plus search funds at this point. I think two which have made investments in the actual acquisition. And so we love that space, and we want to continue in that space, and we're going to continue to do that. So it's been fun, and we love that community. So we'll continue to engage.
That's awesome, Trevor. Let's wrap up with some of your own advice and words of wisdom.
Okay. Well, the advice would be, I think that a lot of people look at this and they think it's a pretty big risk. I could take a job, a consulting firm, an iBanking firm, something that make a lot of money, and it's a pretty easy thing to see your path and it's stable. What I would argue is that the risk is not that big. You might delay your career a year or two. You might do that if the search doesn't work out the way you had hoped. And, you know, there are great, you know, Brian, you know this, there are some great searchers. They do everything right and they don't find the right target. And that's okay. It's better to walk away if you haven't found the right target than to marry up with a company that's going to be a disaster for the next 5-7 years. So you might have a delay in your career, but these are all extremely talented people and they will get a job afterwards. And so it's more of a pause, I would say, in that sort of thing. And the risk isn't as large as it might seem when you're about to go into this. And you learn a lot even during the search. So that's one of the things I'd give advice on. The only other thing we touched on is if you're going to go partner, vet them carefully. I don't know if I believe in sort of throwing a partnership together just to be a partnership. You got to understand the other person and you have to have trust and you have to be able to park those egos.
That's wonderful advice. And obviously having the experience that you did and the success that you've had, I'm sure that our listeners have found this conversation full of learnings from you. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time. On behalf of Booth and the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship, we sincerely thank you for making this investment in the ETA community. So thank you so much, Trevor.
No problem. Thanks very much, Brian. Appreciate it.